At dawn, a bugle had sounded reveille in the dark forest that hid the camps, and they had seen the obscure movement of many persons in the gloom beneath the trees. 20 minutes later, precisely at the moment of good shooting light, the vampires had come whistling in from the west and dropped their napalm canisters. Towering balls of orange flame, shot through with evil black smoke, had erupted into the sky, palling the sunrise. The heat and the chemical stink of the napalm came rolling down to where the scouts lay in ambush. The vampires had deliberately dropped their loads of napalm along the northern perimeter of the camp, sealing off that escape route with a wall of fire. The Canberra bombers came in 20 seconds behind the vampires, and their bomb loads were fragmentation and high explosive. They fell into the camp and jarring, crumping detonations, sending up fountains of dirt and debris, and the trainee guerrillas who survived came out of the forest screaming and howling in a panic-stricken mob. The napalm had cut them off from the north, and they poured into the riverbed and came running directly at the waiting machine guns. Sean let them come, studying them with a detached interest. There were almost as many women as men, but it was difficult to differentiate between the sexes. They wore no uniform. Some were in khaki shorts and T-shirts with portraits of guerrilla leaders or political slogans printed on the chests. Others wore blue denim or bush jackets, and some were bare-chested and in their underwear. Nearly all of them were young, in their middle or late teens, all of them terrified and running blindly to escape the conflagration of napalm and high explosive. They splashed into the pools, and the sand held their feet, slowing them. As they ran, they looked back over their shoulders at the flames and the dust of the camp. So none of them saw the gunners that waited for them on the south bank. The riverbed was filled with struggling humanity, like a pit full of rats. And as the first of them reached the bank on which Sean lay and began to clamber up the steep earthen side, he blew a piercing blast on his whistle. The last note of the whistle was drowned out by gunfire, 300 automatic weapons opening up together. Sean had been hardened by years of brutal warfare, but even he found the carnage stunning. At close range, the volleys of machine gun fire tore a human body to shreds and went on to destroy the next rank and the next. Shot boiled the white sand of the riverbed, so it rose in a fog waist high and turned the running figures to ghostly silhouettes in the dust, and then hid them as they collapsed or were flung carelessly aside by point-blank bursts of fire. The din lasted for 4 minutes, and then there were no more targets, and the guns fell silent. Between them they had fired 50,000 bullets into the riverbed, and the barrels of the guns were so hot that, like the plate of a stove, they ticked and pinkled as they cooled. Though their ears were dulled and numbed by the roar of the gunfire, they could hear the moans and cries of those who still lived in the riverbed. Sean blew another blast on his whistle, and they leapt down the bank and went forward on a skirmishing line. Sean's orders were that the only prisoners to be taken were to be officers or political commissars. As they crossed the river, they shot those who showed any signs of life, holding the muzzles against their heads, a single bullet for each, making certain that they would never recover from their wounds to attack another Rhodesian farmhouse or hack the arms and legs off the black villagers who refused to supply them with food and women. They left nobody alive in the riverbed and then went on to sweep through the camp, tossing grenades into the dugouts, searching the huts for survivors and, more importantly, for maps and documents. Like all good Marxists, the guerrillas were obsessed with record-keeping. The capture of the camp archives was one of the major priorities of Popeye. Racing at the head of his men, Sean was the first to reach the headquarters hut in the centre of the camp. He recognised it by the gaudy flag drooping on its flagpole in front of it. The doorway was dangerous. He fired a burst through the grass wall and then dived in head first through the window. There was a tall black man in the front office. He was dressed in blue denims, and he was scooping armfuls of documents out of the paraffin boxes that served as filing cabinets and dumping them in the centre of the floor. Clearly he was going to attempt to burn them. But now he dropped his armful of paper and reached for the pistol in his holster on his belt. Sean kicked his legs out from under him, and as he dropped, he slammed the butt of his weapon into the side of his neck just below the ear. As Sean rolled to his feet, Matatu appeared beside him like a grinning gnome and stooped to slit the unconscious gorilla's throat with his skinning knife. "No," Sean stopped him. "We want that one." Job was seconds behind him, bursting into the room with a heavy RPD machine gun held ready across the hip. "Okay, Captain," Sean ordered him. "Get a detail to recover all this bumf." He glanced at his watch. "The choppers will be here in 20 minutes. The Rhodesian Air Force was desperately short of helicopters. They were under sanction by every nation in the world, except South Africa, and a British warship was blocking the Mozambique Channel to deny those ports to them. They could risk only 2 helicopters for this operation, and one of them was loaded with captured documents, almost 5 tons of them, lists of the trainees and their organisation, target priorities and supply sheets, equipment dossiers, training manuals, field evaluations of Rhodesian countermeasures, communist propaganda, maps of the attack routes and safe corridors, the entire order of battle of the guerrilla army. It was a treasure trove, its acquisition a greater blow to the enemy than the hundreds of bodies lying in the riverbed. But it filled one of the precious helicopters. The second Alouette helicopter Sean used for Kazvak and for ferrying out the prisoners. However, the scouts had taken more casualties than he had anticipated. 3 troopers had been injured in the parachute drop, torn cartilages and sprained ligaments, and 5 others had been wounded by the desultory and quickly suppressed counterfire of the more plucky of the guerrillas. Then one of the guerrillas had feigned dead in the river bed and thrown a grenade when the scouts came forward, killing a black trooper and wounding 2 others. The scouts always took their dead out for decent burial, and the trooper's corpse was already in its green plastic body bag. In addition to his own casualties, Sean's men had captured 8 suspected officers and commissars. The guerrilla leaders wore no insignia of rank, but could usually be identified by the superior quality of their clothing, by their sunglasses, wristwatches, and by the rows of ballpoint pens in their breast pockets. They had too many passengers for the helicopters, and Sean was forced to keep 5 of his prisoners with him for the outward march. He picked those who looked fit enough to survive a forced march with the scouts, and one of these was the man they had captured in the command hut. 45 minutes after the attack had begun, the last helicopter took off, and the scouts were ready to move out. They could expect the Frelimo counterattack to be dilatory and unenthusiastic, but Sean was taking no chances. He was on the riverbank surveying the carnage of the killing ground. They couldn't afford the time to make a body count, but the Air Force would run another reconnaissance later this morning, and they would get a fair estimate from the photographs. "Must be at least 1,500, Sean decided. They were lying in heaps and windrows like newly cut wheat, and already the flies were hanging over them in a grey mist. Sean turned away from the scene. "All right," he called, "move them out." The first section of 50 men set off at a trot. The troop trucks would race across the border and come in as far as they could meet them. But the men would still have to run 30 miles or more before they could ride, a full marathon under arms. But most of the ammunition had been shot away, and the packs were almost empty. Job hurried across to where Sean stood on the bank. "The prisoner you took, Colonel, I've recognised him. It's Comrade China himself."
"Are you sure?"
Sean didn't wait for Job to reply. "Damn, if I'd known, I would have sent him out on the chopper." Comrade China was high on the wanted list of the Rhodesians. He was the area commander of the entire northeastern sector, the equivalent of a major general, and one of the most successful commanders, a man with a lot of interesting stories to tell to military intelligence.
"Make sure he gets out safely, Captain," Sean ordered brusquely.
Treat him like your new wife. China refuses to march, Job said. We can't shoot him, and we can't carry him. He knows that. Sean strode across to where the prisoner was held under guard. He squatted sullenly with his hands behind his head. On your feet and march, Sean ordered, and Comrade China spat on Sean's boots. Sean unbuckled his holster and drew the .357 Magnum revolver. He laid it against the side of the man's head. On your feet, he repeated. Your last chance. You won't shoot, the man sneered. You daren't shoot. And Sean fired. The muzzle was aimed over Comrade China's shoulder, but the barrel was pressed hard against his ear. Comrade China screamed and clutched at his ear with both hands. A thin trickle of blood from his ruptured eardrum ran out between his fingers. On your feet, Sean said, and still holding his damaged ear, Comrade China spat at him again. Sean laid the revolver barrel against his other ear. After your ears, we will take out your eyes with a sharp stick. Comrade China stood up. At the double, move out. Job took over. He placed his hand between China's shoulder blades and sent him tottering down the river bank. Sean took one more look around the battlefield. It had been done swiftly and thoroughly, what the scouts called a good kill. Orat Matatu, Sean said softly. Let's go home. And the little Ndrobo ran ahead of him. When Comrade China faltered, and his knees went rubbery and he collapsed from the agony of his burst eardrum, Sean gave him a subcutaneous shot of morphine from a disposable syringe and a drink from his water bottle. For a soldier of the revolution who shoots babies and chops the feet off old women, this is a stroll in the park, Sean told him. Brace up, China, or I'll blow your other ear out. And he took one of his elbows, and Job the other. Between them they hoisted him to his feet and half carried him until the morphine had a chance to work. But they kept up the pace of the running column of scouts through the forest and over the rolling rocky hills. You may have killed some of our people today. After a mile or so, the morphine was working, and China became loquacious. Today, you have won a single little battle, Colonel Courtney. But tomorrow, we will have won the war. China's voice was harsh with bitter self-righteousness. How do you know my name? Sean asked with amusement. You are famous, Colonel, or should I say, infamous. Under you, this pack of killer dogs is even more dangerous than when the murderous Ballantyne himself was heading it. Thank you for the pretty compliment, my old China, but aren't you claiming victory a little prematurely? This side, which controls the countryside by night, wins the war. Mao Tse-tung, Sean smiled. A most appropriate quotation for one of your name. We control the countryside at last. We have you bottled up in your villages and towns. Your white farmers are losing heart. Their women are sick of war. The black peasants are openly sympathetic to our cause. Britain and the world are against you, even South Africa. Your only ally is growing disenchanted with the struggle. Soon, very soon. They argued as they ran, and despite himself, Sean could not suppress a grudging admiration for his prisoner. He was quick-witted, his command of English impressive, and his grasp of politics and military tactics even more so. He was physically strong and fit. Sean could feel the wiry muscle in his arm as he supported him, and few other men with a burst eardrum could have sustained the pace of the march. He would make a superb scout, Sean thought, if we could turn him.